Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. You probably don't give vermouth much of a thought. It might come up when you need to mix a martini or a Negroni and you think, now, where did we put that bottle of vermouth? But this is an age of cocktails that have become more popular and more adventurous, at a time when enterprising Vermonters are creating spirits that are the envy of the rest of the world. So here comes Vermont Vermouth, the brainchild of Kobe Schwader, and Kobe is here to share his entree into the world of vermouth. Kobe, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask Kobe a question or tell us how you like to use vermouth, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. It's going to be tough this half hour for me to keep Vermont Viewpoint and Vermont Vermouth separate, but I'm going to try my best, Kobe. All right. First of all, what is vermouth and what do we use it for?
Absolutely. So vermouth, simply put, is wine that's been infused with herbs and spices and then fortified with a little bit of brandy. And then some vermouths are sweetened and some are not. So as you alluded to, most Americans know it as something you use in cocktails like martinis or Manhattans or Negronis. But in Europe, they often just drink it on its own or with a little bit of seltzer water as sort of a late afternoon spritz. And so it's become increasingly popular, especially in Europe, and I'm hoping also in the U.S.
That's right. Well, yeah, what was it, Kobe, that made you say, yeah, vermouth, that is what I need to be making?
So I got interested in vermouth probably 8 or 9 years ago now. I was making a cocktail at home, and I was looking at the bottle and saying, well, what is this? You know, the recipe says put an ounce in, but what am I putting into it? And so I used to be an academic, and so I started doing research and thought, oh, it's just wine with spices in it. I can make that. And I've always been a person who's been interested in flavor. You know, I like to cook and bake and make my own spice blends and homebrew and things like that. And so I started making vermouth at home just for fun, and I started making it for gifts for people for holidays.
As one does.
As one does, right? And so, you know, as I was looking for something new to do with my life, I started doing, you know, some market research into what might be interesting for people, and you know, it remains to be seen whether, you know, my business will succeed or not. We're only about a year old, and most of that has been in a pandemic, but we'll see how it goes. But so, you know, I thought there's been a big boom in craft beer and craft spirits, and there are tons of wonderful local, you know, farm-to-table restaurants that have four different lovely Vermont gins, but if you go ask for a martini, they're going to pour some big mass-market Italian vermouth with that martini. And there's nothing wrong with the big mass-market ones. They're just not, you know, our local flavor.
Now, how is vermouth actually made?
Yeah, so it's winemaking and then additional stuff on top of that. So I make the wine, and then I infuse herbs and spices into it. And there are a bunch of different ways of doing that. I do two different methods. I do a hot steep. So I basically take a little bit of the wine and gently simmer it with herbs, basically make a tea with herbs and spices, and then blend that back in. And I also do a cold steep. So I take the spirits that I'm going to be, the brandy that I'm going to be fortifying my wine with, and I steep herbs and spices in that. And that gets the alcohol-soluble flavors out. And so the combination of those together gets a really sort of broad spectrum of different herbal and spice flavors.
Now, Kobe, the way you're describing it makes me think of something that I was just introduced to a few months ago, the Italian Amaro. Is vermouth on that same kind of in that same family?
Yeah, absolutely. They're very similar. So one of the main differences, although there's a caveat to this, is that Amaros are usually spirit-based. So it's usually just some sort of neutral spirit that's had a bunch of herbs and spices steeped in it, whereas vermouth is wine that has herbs and spices steeped in it. There is something called a vino amaro, though, in Italy, which is a bitter wine is what that means, but it's an amaro made with a wine base. And there's really sort of a continuum between vermouth and wine amaros in that sense, and it's just about what your intent is and what the flavor profile is. Vermouth tends to be on the more, like, lighter side or herbal side, and amaros can get pretty, like, deep and intense. But you know, it's very much a continuum between those two.
All right. And yeah, I would guess, since you use vermouth, in cocktails, you don't want it to be too overpowering for the other things you're using in there. Now, you mentioned your life as an academic. I can't imagine you've been a vermouth maker all your life. So what is your background?
Yeah. So I, I was in academia. I have a PhD in linguistics, and, you know, was all set up to do that for my life. But I just got to the point in academia, and academia is very tough right now. There aren't a lot of jobs. And I was looking for professorships, basically, and spent a couple years doing that and, you know, just unsuccessfully doing that. And realized, you know, between that and talking to some of my friends, I could spend the next 5 to 10 years working terrible adjunct jobs, getting paid nothing, hoping that one day I'll make the breakthrough and get a professorship. And then I might not even like that job.
Right.
So I thought, you know, at some point I need to decide when's the time when I cut and go do something else in my life that I'm going to like and try to, you know, take a different path. And so that's a couple of years ago, that's what I decided to do.
That direct link between linguistics and vermouth.
Yeah.
as blazed by none other than Kobe Schrader, our guest
this morning. We do often like to joke in academia that everyone has a backup plan to go open their craft brewery or local bread bakery place, because, you know, everyone in academia always has, you know, a hobby they do at home to keep themselves sane.
That's right.
So that's always the dream. So we'll see if it actually works.
All right. Well, yeah. I know your timing, not the best, but I think you were planning this well before the pandemic came along. So how did you go about coming up with what was to become your final recipe for Vermont vermouth?
Yeah, so and I'm still developing new recipes and tweaking that. Basically, I just started making batches at home and tweaking them and coming up with recipes I liked. In my head, I have a couple different sort of large classifications of vermouth flavors that I like. And so the ones that I have out now, I've got Zephyr, my dry vermouth, which is sort of my spring idea. So it's really herbal and savory and reminds me of, you know, like spring herbs coming up. I have Boreas, my sweet vermouth, which is sort of my winter idea. So it's really warming and spicy and something I want to like sit by a fire. And then I have an apple vermouth, which is something I don't think anybody else makes. I make the same product. I just start with apple juice instead of grape juice. So it's an apple-based vermouth. And that's sort of my fall idea. So it's got, you know, apple and spice and a little bit of herbs and things like that. So I have those sort of seasonal flavor profiles, but also, I think, yes, like herbs and spices that I think work together really nicely that I try to combine.
Mm-hmm. And you've got more in the pipeline that you're working on?
I do. I've got a new one, I guess. This is the first public announcement.
Oh, breaking news.
I have a rosé vermouth that will be hopefully coming out this summer. The wine's still fermenting at the moment, but it should be ready, I hope, mid-July-ish. And that will be really sort of floral and summery.
Well, you know, now that you've announced it, you've got to get that out by this summer.
Exactly.
You've got to perfect it, Kobe. There's no messing around now. You've been thinking, oh, yeah, this rosé, I think I'll get it out this summer. Oh, wait a minute. I just told the world I've got the rosé vermouth this summer. So there you go. Now you have a deadline, and you've got some motivation to get that out. As you mentioned, there's different flavors. There's different varieties. I want to kind of go through each one individually, give them their due. And let's start with Zephyr. And tell people again, you said that was a dry one.
Yeah, so the two classic styles of vermouth that people are likely to run across are dry and sweet. Also white and red, or Italian and French. Those are all the same. Sorry, French and Italian, the way around. French is the dry one. Those are all the same name or different names for the same things. So dry vermouth is just wine with herbs and spices added and a little bit of brandy. It comes out of the French tradition. And so they tend to be much lighter and subtler more herbal in nature. The Italian vermouth, which are the sweet vermouths, those are running more into the Amaro category. So they tend to be a little bit more intense. Those are also sweetened with caramel. So you have a really nice bittersweet balance between the bitter herbs and the sweet caramel.
Mm-hmm.
So Zephyr, my dry vermouth, is completely dry, so it's sort of very tart and I think quite delicious. And rosemary and yarrow are the main herbs up front, so it has a real sort of like culinary savory note to it.
Yeah.
I think it plays really nicely in cocktails where you want to have other herbs in them, so like things with gin or to have fresh herbs as garnishes, but also can play really nicely with fruity flavors. So you have, you know, some sort of fruity base that you want something a little more herbal or a little different to float over the top of it, that vermouth plays really nicely.
And is this the one we would use in a martini?
Yeah, exactly. The classic martini has dry vermouth in it, and it pairs very nicely. I particularly like it to recommend some Bar Hill, their Tomcat gin, goes very nicely with my Zephyr vermouth.
Oh, my gosh. I'm tasting that right now. I'm a big fan of Bar Hill, and especially that Tomcat gin, which is the barrel-aged gin that they produce. And It is phenomenal. It kind of, when you have it, you think, how did I live my life without this, right? So mix us the perfect martini.
Yeah, so I'm actually a big fan, because I'm a vermouth person, of what's called a reverse cocktail.
Oh.
And that's where you take the what would usually be the modifier and make it the main ingredient. You take what would usually be the main ingredient and make it the modifier. So I like 2 ounces of vermouth and 1 ounce of gin. And so you take that with some ice, you stir it up, and then strain it into a chilled glass. I like a lemon twist with my martinis, so that's my recipe for it. Although, of course, along the continuum of martinis, you can mix sort of any amount of gin with any amount of vermouth as you like. So for people who like more gin, you can lean more towards gin. For people who like more vermouth, you can lean more towards vermouth. And the whole any ratio there will work. Depends on what you like.
Oh my gosh, it sounds phenomenal! And I have to finish this show and drive home, so I cannot pour one. But my goodness, I would love to right now. And Kobe, you mentioned a little earlier you can drink these just by themselves. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think many Americans were introduced to vermouth as something that was sitting at the back of the bar cabinet for years and years.
Right.
But it is actually a wine product. In fact, you may consider it the first pre-bottled cocktail. You've got wine and vermouth and modifiers in it. Or sorry, you've got wine and spirits and modifiers in it. So in Europe, they often drink it on its own, or my favorite way is just with a little bit of seltzer.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a really great sort of low-alcohol cocktail, something you can sip on the porch on a Sunday afternoon.
Wow, I love that idea. All right, so we talked about Zephyr. The next one I'd like you to tell us about is Boreas.
Yeah, so Boreas, my sweet vermouth. In my head, there are sort of two different styles of sweet vermouth. There's sort of the more savory, so you go like bittersweet and savory, and then there's the more spiced version. Boreas is my more spiced idea. So it's got really nice, like, dark fruit and caramel and baking spice notes to it. Makes a really great Manhattan with that. I also particularly like it with an Amaro or with bitter, so something like a Negroni. I think it plays really nicely, and of course, I think it's delicious on its own. And yeah, that one is, I had a lot of fun playing around with it because I make my own caramel to sweeten it. And so I had a lot of fun playing around with different darkness levels to take my caramel to get both some sweetness, but some really nice body, some mouthfeel to it, and some bitterness out of the caramel itself.
Oh, interesting. That's pretty neat. And did you have anyone else serve as your taste testers as you were trying to develop your Vermont vermouths?
Definitely. I think I have a pretty good palate, but I have to also rely on other people to help me out and see what other people are going to like. My main helpers are actually Chris Gagne and Avery Schwenk, who are the owners of Hermit Thrush Brewery down here in Brattleboro.
Oh, they have good taste.
They do. I came up here. They're my old friends. I came up here actually to Brattleboro to work for them for a couple of years, and they were very nice to help me get started with my business and help me figure out how to do that. And also they still serve as my main taste testers and idea bouncers.
Hermit Thrush, outstanding sours, right? That's their kind of sweet spot.
Yeah, definitely.
Not to be punny, but yeah. And so I hope people up in this part of the state and elsewhere have found their way to trying Hermit Thrush. I think they are all over the state now and well-known, but a great brewery there in Brattleboro. Now, when you take them out to the public, I don't know how much you've been able to do that, but how much explaining do you need to do to acquaint people with what you're doing with the vermouths that you've produced?
I find it is actually very dependent on the age of the person. I find it really interesting. I think there's a missing gap. So I think Manhattans and martinis were very popular in like the 50s and 60s, and so people who were of age in that era remember, they're like, oh, we used to have martinis and Manhattans at my parties when I was in my 20s and 30s. And so they know exactly what I'm doing. Then it sort of skipped a generation, so their children will often be like, vermouth, why would you want to drink that? That's something my parents used to drink. But after hearing that it's just, you know, wine with herbs and spices, they go, oh, actually, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I like wine, I like herbs and spices. And then I think younger people, you know, under 30 now, because cocktails have become more popular, are starting to understand what vermouth and Amaro and things in that family are again also.
Yeah, okay, good. So you just got to fill in the gaps a little bit. Now, the third in your Vermont vermouth lineup is Harvest. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this one's my oddball. I was looking around at what local ingredients. I try to get all my stuff as locally as possible. And so I was looking around and said, you know, we've got really great apples here, and I don't know why you couldn't do the exact same production process, just start with apple juice instead of grape juice. So I get some apples from Dutton Farm in Newfane. They're right next door to me. And basically do the same process. So I ferment the apple juice into apple wine. And then I infuse it with herbs and spices. And I made this one. It's a sweet vermouth style also. It's not quite as sweet as Boreas is, but it's generally sweet vermouth style. And I really wanted to play around with the flavor someone would expect from apple. So it does start with a little bit of sort of like pie spice notes. I found that just centers the apple flavor a little bit. But then in the background, there's a lot of herbs, things like anise hyssop, which has sort of a licorice-y note to it.
Right.
Some mugwort and yarrow, which adds some bitterness. So it's a really interesting twist on a normal vermouth. And I recommend, when people are asking what to do with it, I recommend basically replacing sweet vermouth anywhere you would want some apple flavor. So I think it plays particularly well with rye for a rye-based Manhattan. The spiciness of rye and apple are a great pair together. And then I've also been having lots of fun playing around with other things. I actually found that it plays really nicely with Aperol, which is an Italian orange bitter liqueur. You get sort of an apple and orange spice note to it, which becomes very interesting. It was sort of my curveball, something new that I don't think anybody else is making. And it's gotten pretty good feedback so far.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the feedback. Are mixologists excited to learn about your vermouths and to try them in their cocktails?
Yeah, definitely. And as I mentioned earlier, vermouth has become, other fortified wines and other Amaros and things in that family have become very popular in Europe over the last 10 years, and that's starting to bleed over. So people who are on the sort of, mixologists and bartenders and bar managers who are on the cutting edge of getting, really interesting things into their bars are starting really seriously to look at more interesting fortified wines, more interesting vermouths. It's always fun because you can get a completely new cocktail using the exact same recipe if you change up what your vermouth is, in the same way that, if you change up what your gin is, it would change the martini a lot.
Yeah. Now, has anyone come up with a cocktail specifically for one or more of your vermouths, or am I just little bit ahead? Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
No, definitely. We're always working on that. I've actually, this summer, actually, it's starting this Saturday, the Brattleboro Farmers Market. I'm teaming up with Appalachian Gap Distillery, so we'll both be at the same booth, so people can, one-stop shopping for all your cocktail needs. So we've been having a lot of fun playing around with their spirit, specifically with my vermouth, to try to come up with fun, unique cocktails. And two of the really interesting ones we've come up with, one of them is with their Papilio, which is an agave spirit, so it's basically the tequila. And it pairs really nicely with Zephyr, my dry vermouth. Something about the brightness of the Zephyr almost plays the role of lime, like lime would with normal tequila. And has a really interesting twist on, it's like somewhere between a martini and a margarita. A really fun, bright, vibrant flavors. And the other pair is with their Peregrine gin, which is a really interesting gin. It's sort of more savory. It has some interesting spices in it that I'm not used to tasting in gin. And that pairs really nicely with Harvest, my apple one, to bring out some of those, deeper savory notes.
You've mentioned your apples come from nearby. I think you get a lot of your herbs from close by as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The large majority of my herbs come from Foster Farm Botanicals, which are in Calais. They grow amazing organic herbs. It's the kind of thing that they're inside of packaging, inside a box, and I can smell the herbs from outside the box. They're just incredibly fragrant. I love working with them.
Oh, my gosh. That must be great when you get them. Now, you launched your products in February of 2020, and I can hear, listeners groaning in sympathy for you, Kobe. But how has this past year been for Vermont Vermouths?
It's been tough, mostly because most of my business plan is to get into bars and restaurants.
Yeah.
And with bars and restaurants either completely shut down or on very, very limited budgets, I've had a lot of interactions with bar managers that say, hey, we love your product. We're just not in the position to buy new things. We're going through all our backstock. We're only doing takeout, those sorts of things. It's been tough. I hope it'll pick up as things open up more this summer. I think we'll get, more. I've already gotten some more interested people reaching back out to me being like, oh, hey, you we were interested before and now we can actually plan to buy some.
Now,
so on one hand, it was tough. On the other hand, it gave me more time to figure out my process because everything was moving super slow outside of it. So,
right.
Yeah. And if I make it in the long term, maybe it'll have been a hidden blessing that I got some more time to work on the back end of things without having to deal with the front end.
Yeah. I mean, you're actually approaching it just right. I was going to ask you how your business plan has changed, and you use this time, even though it's more difficult, it's kind of forced, but rather than sit around and just, let things happen, you're making things happen. You're finding, refining the process, which is great. Now, where can people find Vermont Vermouth?
Absolutely. So in Vermont, vermouth is regulated more or less like a spirit.
Okay.
And so it's available at the Vermont State Liquor Stores, the 802 Spirits stores. If your particular store doesn't have it, you can order it through them. So you can go to your local store and say, hey, will you order me some Vermont Spirits? And they can do that. Wine stores can also get a special permit to carry fortified wines. So anyone who's a wine store owner listening, you're welcome to do that, and I can help you. You can get in touch with me. And then I'm also available at the Brattleboro Farmers Market.
And then what size bottles is Vermont Vermouth sold in?
I have two different size bottles. I have basically normal size wine bottles, 750 milliliters, and then I have half wine bottles, 375 milliliters. The small bottles are what have been distributed out to the liquor stores so far. But I also have big bottles, and you can special order those from your local liquor store. So I like the little bottles, especially for individual users, because it means that the wine won't spoil as fast, or you'll be able to go through it before it spoils. You don't have to commit to a large bottle.
And once we open it, should we refrigerate it? Should it be served chilled?
Yes and yes. So it's a wine product. It's a fortified wine product. So it'll last longer than a normal bottle of wine.
Okay.
But like normal wine, the sort of more light or oxygen or heat it gets, the more flavors will disappear faster. So basically, when you open it, keep it corked and in the fridge, and it should last you a couple weeks, if not a couple months. And it sort of depends on how much you like it. And then after that, it's not like it'll spoil and go bad. It just, you'll lose a lot of the more interesting flavors. It'll become a much more boring product.
Okay.
I usually like to cook with it when it gets to that point.
Oh, interesting. What have you made with some of your vermouths?
Yeah, so the easiest thing I do most often is just to make a pan sauce with it. So when I'm done searing or grilling something, you can add a little bit of vermouth, just like where you would add wine to make a pan sauce. You can use vermouth instead, and it basically already has all of your herb flavors in it. And then it's also really fun to add to gravies and stews. Again, it adds a lot of acidity and brightness and herbal flavors. So if you want something to brighten up a little bit, it's a great thing to add a splash of vermouth in.
All right. And I think you told us about the rosé vermouth. Any other new products you're thinking about in the future?
I have some other flavor ideas floating around in my head, but nothing has settled yet. So I don't want to announce anything too soon.
I've already made you announce one on the air, so that should be enough for me.
But yeah, I'm always thinking about new recipes and trying to think what new products would be good in the future. So
new
things will be coming out as we go.
That sounds great. Kobe Schwader, the owner and vermouth maker at Vermont Vermouth, and you can learn about more at vermontvermouth.co, right? .co?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay, vermontvermouth.co.co. Kobe, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It was nice to talk to you.
All right. Take care. It was great. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. And when we return, we're going to head to Tunbridge to hear about an innovative reading program that is bridging the generation gap. And a reminder that the Sox are back in action tonight on the road against the Mets. They're going to play the Mets before they even play the Yankees this year. The first time they play the Yankees is in early June. How crazy is that? All right. That coverage tonight, 6:10, first pitch, 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Think of those amazing bonding moments we have with young children reading to them. Parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles can pick up Sheep in a Jeep or Goodnight Moon and read to a young child who listens in rapt attention. But then it stops, I don't know, maybe around age 6 or 7. But why? Why can't that reading connection continue? Well, maybe it can, and maybe the folks at the Tunbridge Public Library have come up with a way to bridge the generation gap and to get all of us to set aside our electronics for a while and discuss and learn. We're going to learn about a program that the library has instituted. It's a multi-age book club, and it's called Generation Connect. Joining us to talk about it is Library Director Mariah Lawrence. Mariah, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question about Generation Connect or if you want to share how you've bonded with youngsters through reading, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mariah, before we get there to that program, give us a little tour of your library.
Oh, well, we are so lucky. Our library was actually built in, it was originally a house built in 1830, and it is an incredibly beautiful building that's had some amazing additions since then. I believe it was 2012. We built an amazing community room. We have two children's rooms and a beautiful lighting in the big open area for all the adult sections. It's really a space of community.
Oh, I love it. Now, the Friends of Tunbridge Library had a meeting on Saturday to strengthen its position in the community as a cultural center in town. Did any ideas come out of that meeting for use of the library?
Oh, well, you know, our main point of conversation was how to continue to incorporate pie at our town meeting despite COVID restrictions. So
I'm moving to Tunbridge.
Yeah, but we definitely had lots of great ideas of interesting and new fundraisers that we look forward to sharing with everyone.
How do you see the role of your library in your community?
Well, I think that a small and rural library is in a really unique position to be the center of the community. Basically, there isn't a gathering space, and to have this opportunity to like allow people to gather at the library is, you know, not lost on me. It's really, really an important spot.
Nice. All right. Now we're going to get to Generation Connect. So tell us what it is.
Yeah. So Generation Connect was sort of an idea that we came up with at the beginning of COVID to try to stave off loneliness for people who might be experiencing it. And it really didn't come into fruition until we got a CLIF grant later on in the year, the Children's Literacy Foundation, and as part of it, you have this little mini grant. And when we got it, we thought, this is the perfect opportunity to try this book club out. And it's essentially, you can do it, it's a choose-your-own-adventure book club. We wanted to make sure that everybody felt that there was a space for them, and whether they wanted to do the Zoom meetings or they just wanted to meet with a partner and discuss a book that everybody would enjoy, that there was a path for them to enjoy this book. The first book we chose was A Wolf Called Wander, which was a surprisingly wonderful pick for an all-ages book group because it was a true story, but you know, told through the eyes of a wolf, so obviously with a fictional spin, and everybody seemed to really, really love it.
When you first approach people, young and old, about this idea, this Generation Connect and taking part in it, what was the reaction that you got?
Well, I think people are really interested because the perspectives that can come from people, you know, of different ages is so unique, and really brings a richness to stories. So people really were excited about it. I mean, with the initial group, we had 33 people sign up, which is a lot for a small area. So, you know, I think it was something that people were really drawn to, and to have something to talk to their grandkids about, to center a conversation around, was really appealing.
Explain the logistics of how it works.
Yeah, so I thought about it kind of like, you know, you get those monthly kits in the mail for, like, I don't know, like wine of the month or whatever club or whatever that might be. I kind of wanted it to be like that, where you get your...
We're talking about 8-year-olds, 8 years old people. Mariah,
well,
you know that, right?
It's what inspired me, okay?
All right, just checking.
I thought about it like, you know, you could pick up the package with everything you need for the book club here at the library, or if your partner was far away, we would mail it off to you. And so in the package, you have your a copy of the book to keep. We had lists of ideas of ways to connect with your partner or with a group, and then also an art kit, because there was like an art component to the book club. We would meet up and do like a another paint and sip. So obviously, that's where my inspiration came from.
Apparently.
So, yeah.
And did someone have to have a partner? Like, did a grandparent have to have a grandchild somewhere? Or if somebody just said, I'll volunteer and read and I can be partnered with someone, how did that work?
Yeah, so originally I thought you would need a partner to do it. But then after the first group meeting, we had several people that didn't have a partner and were like, well, let me just try it. And it worked out beautifully. So in the next meeting, we decided, you know, partner, no partner, it really doesn't matter. We just want everyone's perspective. And we ended up getting every decade represented from 0 to 80.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so wonderful. So yeah. What were some of the really great discussions that you heard from that first go-round of Generation Connect?
Well, the one that's fresh in my memory is from the second one. So I'm never.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
we read Where the Mountain Meets the Moon by Grace Lynn for our second group. And we had a discussion where people talked about what it meant to be a friend, to be a good friend. And that was so beautiful to hear the different ages describe that, because everybody had something, but one little girl mentioned to be brave. You know, to be brave and to be a friend no matter how it felt. And I just thought that was so beautiful. We were all tearing up.
Yeah, you're getting me. I'm a little verklempt. And how did the younger readers react to being part of a book club of this sort?
Yeah, I think they could feel that it was special. I think that the younger kids could understand that to be in a group with all ages, you know, you could see them. We really wanted to hear from the younger kids more during the discussions, and when we did, yeah, I think that they could really tell that it was a space that they were appreciated.
Mm. And how about those the most senior members?
Yeah, I know that it brought some joy to their lives. I heard a lot of feedback from people about how they really enjoyed having more to ask their grandkids or their neighbors rather than just, you know, how was school? How was your day? They, like, loved having a conversation to center it around. And, of course, we all appreciated the real wisdom in their responses. There was perspectives that were very different from our own, and it was really lovely.
Mm. Mariah, you're getting ready to launch Generation Connect 3.0, I believe. How many people are repeat participants in the program?
Yeah, so I partnered with Elizabeth Morrison of the Chelsea Public Library for this next round.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have actually a little bit of a different crew this time, which is really exciting. We tried to focus on the two towns of Chelsea and Tunbridge as our schools are merging, and we just thought building community through books could be a really useful way to spend our time. And so we have some repeat people, but we have lots of new people, which is really exciting.
Oh, that's great. Do you know how many participants you do have for this one?
I believe we have, I think we have about five spaces left right now.
Oh, okay.
So I think that brings us to close to 20 people.
All right. And how can someone join in if they want to be part of this?
Yeah, so they can just send us an email. My email is tunbridgelibrary@gmail.com or give us a call at 889-9404.
Okay. All right. So you have Chelsea on board, but have you heard from other libraries who want to know about the logistics of doing something like this?
Yeah, we've definitely offered to help people get this started in their community, because why reinvent the wheel? It's a really great program. And I've talked to Tyler at the South Royalton Library and Shana at the Baxter Memorial Library, and partnering with other people is a really great way to spread the joy. So,
all right. Now, I want to ask you about some of the other things that are in the works for your library. You're creating an outdoor space at the library. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so one of the silver linings of COVID, right, is that we all are spending a lot more time outside, and it sort of just came to my attention that the outdoor space at our library is really, really beautiful, and we have gorgeous gardens, and why not make this space something that we can hang out and sit on a picnic table and read books and let your kid play in a sandbox and drink coffee. So we're trying to put a fence around the library and create a story hour space out back and have an awning and just a really wonderful place to enjoy the Wi-Fi and books and company. So.
And what about story walk installations?
Yeah, so we have a story walk installation down at the fairgrounds right now. And last year it was really great because there were no events at the fairgrounds. So the story walk and there was also barbecue were like main events in Tunbridge. And it got a lot of traffic and it was really wonderful. The fairgrounds are letting us keep it up, which is great, but we thought we could even put the story walk around the library in the future. So that's something we're definitely fundraising for and thinking about in the future.
Now, I didn't grow up with story walk, so tell people what that is.
Yeah, so story walk is when you take apart a book and each page is laminated with a very thick lamination and posted about 10 feet away from one another. So you walk through a path or, you know, even some are set up through a forest and read the book as you go along.
All right. How about, do you have outreach programs that institute there at the Tunbridge Public Library?
Yeah, it's a good question because we actually just started yesterday.
My timing's impeccable.
Yeah, exactly. We went to the school and I got to visit Caitlin McLaughlin's second grade class, and I went to her outdoor classroom and brought my special reading milestone golden chair. I have a golden chair that kids can sit in when they learn to read, and we take their picture and post it on our Reading Hall of Fame board. And I read them stories, and they brought home little kits to take home to show their parents, and it was a really lovely day spreading the joy of public libraries.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about whether the library has books about the natural history of Vermont.
Oh, great question. Can you answer that, Mariah?
Yeah, the director before me, Gene Wolfe, has done an amazing job building up our collection, and we have a really, really wonderful local history and Vermont collection. Yeah, definitely come down and check it out.
Stephen, are there any specific natural history publications that you think should be included in every library here in Vermont?
Well, I think Charles Johnson's The Nature of Vermont.
All right.
I'm gonna write that down.
And then Nona Estrin's books about nature.
All right.
And then also the book by the first Vermont naturalist, whose name I can't remember at the moment.
And I should remember that. I think we had a discussion about that a few weeks ago.
We did. Yes.
Yeah. Boy, that just shows you how much I'm retaining. But we'll try to find that. But thank you, Stephen. Those are great suggestions.
Oh, and also something that might be of interest to people is there are books and brochures about building bat houses.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's something that might be relevant at this time of year.
Absolutely. Yeah, what a great project for people to take part in. So people can look for that. Mariah, how long have you been at the Tunbridge Public Library?
Oh, I started working there in 2018, and I've been the director for exactly 1 week now.
So. Oh, my goodness. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And is this an honor or a hazing to be put on the radio with me just a week?
Oh, a little bit of both, I would have to say. Yeah.
Wow. So, what are your plans? You're now the director at the Tunbridge Public Library. I know you're just a week in, but have you really thought about, you know, the direction or things you'd like to institute? You know, where do you see things going?
Yeah, so I'm really lucky that I live in a community where the stage has really been set for a culture of literacy. We have so many wonderful people in this community that have spent their life going into the schools and particularly preschools and reading and spreading the joy of reading to everyone. And I definitely hope to continue that. The after school, creating an after school program is high on my list of priorities. Continuing the outreach programs to the school, I have set up to go see the first grade next Monday and the kindergarten the week after that. And those are really the most important things to me, getting out of the library and into the schools and just making sure that everybody knows that the public library is a space for them.
Outstanding. Zadok Thompson is the early conservationist naturalist from Vermont, who we were trying to think of, by the way. Definitely Zadok Thompson. Yeah, we talked about him. Let's see. I know there's some other programs that you have, and we have just a few minutes, but the chapter book program, tell us about that.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the pandemic, I read to kids 3 days a week, just trying to, you know, keep them reading, keep them interested in books, that we've cut back to once a week. And so a group of kids and I meet up on Zoom on Fridays, and we just read books and talk about what books we're loving and just enjoy each other's company, really. We also have a Lego club that runs right. every Wednesday night.
I think I've aged out of that popular. One, but yeah.
What was that?
I said I think I aged out of that one, unfortunately.
Well, everyone's welcome at Lego Club. I mean, we have a really good time. I actually have been buying my own Lego sets for the first time ever. I made a desk organizer last week. So.
Oh, good. All right. And one more thing is the Fiber Group. What's that about?
Yeah, the Fiber Group is a group that met in our library before COVID. And they're a really wonderful group of crafters, and now they meet on Zoom on the first and third Wednesday of the month from 6 to 8. And, yeah, I totally recommend anyone who's new to crafting or has been crafting for a long time to come to the group, because they're a wealth of information.
Well, I'm really excited that you're working to, you know, kind of light that fire of literacy in youngsters. I've been involved with two literacy groups. One, Everybody Wins Vermont, and the other was at Essex Elementary. They did a books and breakfast program that I was involved with as well, in reading with children K through 2. And boy, the rewards are just immense. So really,
it is a great program.
Yeah, Mariah Lawrence is the new 1 week old Library Director at the Tunbridge Public Library. To learn about the programs that they're putting on, you can go to tunbridgelibrary.org. Mariah, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
All right, and good luck with the next generation of Generation Connect. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll be back to learn about a Vermonter who became a leading voice in Congress to end slavery in the South. And a reminder that this morning at 11, we'll be going to the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Back in 2014, the Danville Post Office was named after someone named Thaddeus Stevens, a guy who lived back in the 1800s and was a congressman representing Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And now a history professor from the University of Illinois has a new book about Stevens. It's called Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice. We're going to spend the next hour learning about this Vermont-born statesman and the impact that he had on ending slavery in this country. Here to guide us through it is historian and author Bruce Levine. Professor Levine, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Thank you for having me. Please call me Bruce.
Okay, I sure will. And listeners, if you have a question for Bruce about Stevens' life, or if you've been studying it yourself and have anything to add, give us a call. We're at 244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bruce, start us with Stevens' life in Vermont and his family here.
Well, as you said or implied, he was born in 1792 in Danville to Joshua Stevens and Sarah Morrill Stevens. He was apparently named after Tadeusz Kościuszko, the Polish general who joined the American Revolutionary Forces because of his sympathy for the cause. And that naming captured Stevens' family's dedication to the cause of the American Revolution. And in later years, Stevens would vividly remember his family's dedication not only to the revolution, but to its most democratic document, the Declaration of Independence. He was born into a poor farm family that had migrated to Vermont from Massachusetts in search of better and cheaper land, as many other residents of Massachusetts did. He was born into, as I said, a poor family. He was born with a physical deformity. He had a club foot. One of his three brothers had two club feet, and that made them incapable of doing much of the heavy labor necessary on farms, and so that simultaneously undermined the family's economic position even further, but it also destined him for non-agricultural occupation, as his mother early recognized. And so she set out to fit him for a profession and concentrated on his education. The family were Baptists, and that was a religion that could trace its ancestry back to the revolution in England during the 17th century that had overthrown the monarchy there during the middle of that century. And it was a religion that put great store on individual conscience, individual decision, and community welfare. And those values clearly found their way deeply into Thaddeus Stevens' own values and personality and priorities.
What took the family to Pennsylvania then?
Well, I think it was the fact that Vermont soil was wearing out, and this was a problem in much of New England. The soil tended to be rocky and tended not to be terribly fertile, and so as the number of residents increased, a rather massive population migration began out of existing New England settlements, and Vermont was one of the destinations for those migrants. And Vermont was a part of the region that actually had to tear itself free from the clutches of first the province, the colony of New York, and then the state of New York.
Right. So what did Thaddeus do before entering politics?
Well, he was an attorney, and he had become an attorney in Pennsylvania after migrating out of Vermont, because although the soil in Vermont was better than the soil in Massachusetts, occupational opportunities were far greater in Pennsylvania than they were in Vermont, especially for someone seeking a professional position. And a friend of his had found a job teaching in Pennsylvania, and so he apparently followed that friend's footsteps into Pennsylvania. And while he was teaching, he studied for the bar and passed it in the neighboring state of Maryland. And so that became his profession and source of income.
Describe the person you've written about, this Thaddeus Stevens. He really is an interesting person, a quick wit, Someone who really, thank goodness, he wasn't just a farmer, and I don't mean that derogatorily, but he really did learn quite well, and became really important and quick-witted. Tell us about him.
Well, just as you say, he was extremely quick on the trigger. He had a very sharp tongue, and he was very free with its use. And so he became very famous as a person whom you didn't want to take on in a verbal battle. And so there are a whole series of his quotations that reflect this fact. So one day he's walking down a rather narrow lane and finds himself confronting a hostile political opponent. And the opponent looks at him and sneers, "I never stand aside for a skunk." And immediately, Stephen says, "Well, I always do." And he steps aside and lets the other guy pass. He regularly said the kind of things that the rest of us think of day after that kind of conversation and wish we had thought of it at the time.
I love it. Well, here's this guy from Vermont, makes his name in Pennsylvania as a congressman there. So what's your interest in Thaddeus Stevens?
Well, I grew up in the era of the 1960s civil rights movement and have always been strongly attached to that cause. As a kid, I watched African Americans being beaten and hosed down by police in southern towns and cities as they sought simply to sit and walk and be present at places that whites automatically were permitted to do. Mm-hmm. And that dedication stuck with me, and when I learned later on that this struggle had been going on for centuries and that the Civil War was a pivotal moment in that struggle, I wanted to learn more about that. In college, I learned that Thaddeus Stevens was a key, if not the key figure, leading forward the white people who were dedicated to putting an end to slavery and then to expanding the rights won by the former slaves to include all those civil and political rights that white people routinely enjoyed. And the more I read about him, the more I admired his courage, the more I admired his steadfastness, his energy, his will, his dedication to the cause, his increasingly democratic outlook, small d, of course, and his leadership. And I think that this leadership role he played is badly underattended in history books and almost unknown to the general public.
Yeah. What drew him into politics in the first place, Bruce?
That's a good question. I think he had been heavily influenced by the political atmosphere in which he grew to adulthood in Vermont. Vermont, as you probably know, was the most radically democratic state in the early Union. It had been born in a struggle in defense of the right of small farmers to keep their land against attempts by New Yorkers to take that land away from them and make it their own. That was a state that then went on to fashion for itself the most democratic, or one of the two or three most democratic state constitutions in the Union, creating the one of the largest or most broadest-based electorates, the most democratically organized legislatures, and so on. And, just as important, the first state constitution in the United States to denounce slavery in so many words in its own text.
Right.
And I think all of those values, plus those reinforced by his Baptist faith, and then what he learned in his formal education, geared him in the direction of carrying out and implementing those values politically.
He started politically as a state representative in Pennsylvania. What did he stand for politically in those early days?
Well, one of the things he stood for was public education, the right of citizens to have free public, or as they then called it, common schooling, through what we would call elementary school, at least. And that was very controversial in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
At that time, it was something that had by then become a norm in his native New England, but was still resisted in most of the rest of the country, especially in the South, but also the Middle Atlantic states. And so Stevens had to fight very hard in support of a bill that came into the Pennsylvania House of Representatives that would, for the first time, create public or common schools free of charge for residents of the state. And there was tremendous resistance to this idea among people who had a much narrower conception than did Stevens of the proper role of the government. And, of course, this is an issue that remains with us very much alive today.
Yeah.
There were all sorts of people, including many, many of his own constituents, whose attitude was, why should I pay taxes for a service that I or my own family members may not want or need to take advantage of? If I don't have kids going to school or wanting to go to school, why should I have to pay taxes to support that? And Stevens fought very hard to try to explain to those constituents that an educated public was something not only beneficial but necessary to the welfare of everyone, whether they had children in school or not, just as public support for libraries or other things that Thaddeus Stevens supported in the name of public welfare, such as roads, canals, railroads, port facilities, and so on. And Stevens strongly believed in government support to all these things, because Stevens strongly believed in the importance of what was then called the free labor economy and what we would today call a capitalist economy. Hmm. In its early years, he, like so many others, saw in capitalism the engine of human progress in general. And so he believed, and he did not believe the system would successfully take off on its own. It needed the active support of government, just as education and other services were necessary to make the opportunities offered by capitalism available to all.
Bruce, the political party system was much different in the early through mid-19th century. It seemed to be in its formative stages. Explain what was happening in that respect in our country.
Well, I will do that as best I can. It's a complicated story, Rick, as I think you know. I just wanted to add a thing or two to the answer I gave to your last question.
Sure.
What were his politics in Pennsylvania? Thaddeus Stevens, by the middle of the 1830s, was in all important respects an abolitionist. He was not only for putting an end to slavery as soon as possible, and as soon as possible meant as soon as constitutionally possible, but also for equal political rights for African Americans, which was a position held by virtually nobody in Pennsylvania. So after he lost his seat in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives because his own constituents didn't like his adamant support for public education, they then, however, did send him to the Constitutional Convention drawing up amendments to the state constitution taking place the following year. And there the question came up again, as it had at the beginning of the state's history, who should be allowed to vote? And the existing wording was ambiguous on the subject of racial barriers to voting. And this convention decided, over Stevens' loud protest, to restrict for the first time explicitly the right to vote to white men. And previously, African Americans in parts of the state had routinely been permitted to vote. Now the Constitution of the state was going to bar them. Stevens refused to sign the resulting Constitution. So strong was his opposition to this one part of it. And this is the beginning of his fight, not only against slavery, but for equal rights for black and white. Now, your more recent question, and thank you for allowing me to amend
Absolutely.
My earlier answer.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called founding fathers did not believe in political parties. They inherited a view of how republics best function from the ancient republics of Greece and Rome down through the Middle Ages city republics in Europe, according to which political parties were the beginning of the end of republics. They divided the public, they created hostility within the public, and they paved the way for the destruction of those republics in one way or another. But very, very soon, after the creation of the American Republic, of course, political differences began to emerge among both the elected leaders and among the electorate. And as people who agreed with one another discovered, if they worked together, they could increase their political clout, and that, of course, is how political parties form. So willy-nilly, political parties began to come into existence. First of all, the so-called Federalist Party, led by people like Alexander Hamilton, and then the Anti-Federalists, later known as Democrats, initially led by Thomas Jefferson. But later on, Stevens winds up a member of a party that very few people know about and whose description sounds very odd. It was called the Anti-Masonic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And its primary purpose was to combat the Order of Masons, which sounds, as I say, rather ridiculous today, considering the benign nature of the Masons.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, the Masons were something different than they are today. They were a secretive organization of well-to-do individuals, by and large, who pledged themselves formally to support one another in all aspects of life, economic and political, over anyone else. And to many people, this seemed like a real threat to a democratic republic. If there are people already well-heeled who are using their power secretly in concert to favor one another over anyone else, for example, seeking public office, this seemed like a serious threat to the republic. And many people joined Masonic parties, particularly in New England and the Middle Atlantic states. And Stevens became a leader of that party as an extension of his solid belief in democratic forms of government.
And I bring up the political party because he seemed to almost be have a political philosophy that was in search of a political party, and moved around quite a bit. He was in the Whigs. Eventually, this new party, the Republican Party, seemed to be the best place for him, the best fit. We only have a couple minutes before another break, but what did that Republican Party stand for when he became a member?
The Republican Party that formed in the middle of the 1850s was an anti-slavery party, but it did not stand for the immediate abolition of slavery throughout the country because it believed that the Constitution made it impossible for the federal government to pass that kind of legislation. It did, however, stand for preventing the spread of slavery into what were then extensive federal territories in the West. And it believed, furthermore, that slavery was a system that had to keep expanding geographically in order to survive. So if they could prevent its further expansion, that would lead to its choking to death, and it would lead southern states to recognize that their slave system was doomed, and therefore they would have to put an end to it themselves.
And despite his anti-slavery stance, Stevens, as far as immigration stood, he was a nativist, right?
Yes, he was a nativist. He colluded with nativist organizations, nativist sentiment, anti-immigrant sentiment, suspicion of immigration was very strong in the southern tier of Pennsylvania, and Stevens took advantage of that fact and very likely believed in nativist principles. He was not known as a fighter for the nativist cause, but he clearly benefited from nativist support, and he sought that support and was willing, if not eager, to politically advance its program, which centered on excluding the foreign-born from the vote, ironically, considering his previous dedication to expanding the suffrage. And he stood by that sense of that series of nativist values down until around 1860.
Right. We've got to pop out for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to learn more about Thaddeus Stevens with University of Illinois history professor Bruce Levine. Listeners, to join in, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. University of Illinois history professor Bruce Levine has a new book out about a Vermonter who worked hard to end slavery. The book is Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice. And we're learning about the life of this extraordinary man. Listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Bruce, there seemed to be a lot of compromise going on for a long time when it came to slavery. Can you tell us about the compromise of 1850 and how Stevens reacted to that?
Sure, Rick. The compromise of 1850 arises because of a major political conflict that breaks out in the country during and after the war with Mexico. A war that begins in 1846 and which is really designed to tear off a huge piece of the Mexican landmass. In fact, I believe about half of all of Mexico is, as a result of that war, absorbed into the United States. And that's the American Southwest, the U.S. Southwest, and California and parts of Texas. And the party to which Stevens had belonged at that point, the Whig Party, had opposed that war, and that opposition became a moot point once the war was won. And then the next question was, what will happen to the territories taken from Mexico? Specifically, will slavery be allowed to take root there? And that became a source of tremendous controversy between North and South. Northerners generally wanted to keep it out. Southerners demanded that slavery be allowed in, and that's why they and their political representatives had fought so hard to embark upon that war and then to take away that land from Mexico, precisely to plant slavery upon that land. In order to put an end to this controversy, a compromise was struck at the behest of the Kentucky Whig Henry Clay, which becomes known as the Compromise of 1850. And in a series of resolutions, this compromise provides that California will make its own decision on the subject as a state, but that the rest of the territories of the Southwest will decide as territories, not yet as states, whether or not slavery will be permitted there. And then, as an added sop to the slave owners, also included is a new fugitive slave law that makes it easier for those who claim that they own human beings who have escaped from them into free states, a law that will help those slave owners recapture those slaves. Excuse me. And furthermore, compel any northerner in the vicinity to join the posse hunting down those alleged fugitives, and then giving those fugitives no right to defend themselves in court or anywhere else before being hauled into slavery once again. Well, Stevens adamantly opposes the Compromise of 1850, and that's not a popular position. Once again, Abraham Lincoln, for example, who unquestionably hated slavery, nonetheless endorsed that compromise and would later praise Henry Clay for having fashioned it and would excoriate those who had opposed it. And those who had opposed it, of course, included Thaddeus Stevens. Stevens wanted no part of it. And that was the beginning of the end of Thaddeus Stevens' membership in the Whig Party.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Lincoln. At the time, he was a senator from Illinois, I believe, right? He was definitely not president of the United States.
No, he certainly wasn't president. He had recently been a congressman from Illinois. He had only served one term, so he wasn't in Congress at the time that the compromise passed, but he was a public figure who made his and a major figure in the state's Whig Party and had made his support for that compromise known and would stand by that compromise retrospectively for many years afterward.
So what happened in that next decade, 1850 to 1860, in the country between that compromise and the eventual election of Abraham Lincoln as president of the United States?
Well, in one of the more than few moments when Stevens accurately predicts the future, he warns that the decision to allow slavery to expand into the Southwest based on what was then called popular sovereignty, the right of white men in a territory to legalize slavery there, he warns that this is going to become the source of great political crisis in the country again, this precedent. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. In 1854, Stephen Douglas, whom you mentioned earlier, brings a bill into Congress that is intended to give political form to what remains of the old Louisiana Purchase, parts of the Louisiana Purchase, extensive parts, that had not yet even been formed into federal territories. And in order to get Southern support for this bill, he includes so-called popular sovereignty in the bill, namely the provision that slavery's future in the territories will be decided by the white residents of those territories. Well, the Compromise of 1820, a compromise struck at the time that Missouri entered the Union, had excluded slavery from all that land in the newly acquired region of the Louisiana Purchase, north of 36 degrees, 30 minutes latitude. So this was throwing out the Compromise of 1820 and was basically saying, therefore, to the North, not only will we allow slavery into this region previously closed to slavery, but you will never again be able to have confidence that any compromise you strike with the slaveholders will be honored by them any longer than they need to honor it. And as soon as they can overthrow it, they will do that. And so there is a political tornado let loose in the free states in response to Douglas's bill, known as the Kansas-Nebraska bill, after the new territories to be created. And that public uproar, which includes both Whigs and Democrats in the North, eventually gives birth to the Republican Party. If finally, a huge portion of the Northern electorate have decided that if they want to stop the spread of slavery, they had better form a political party capable of doing that, and that none of the existing political parties, neither the Whigs nor the Democrats, were going to serve that purpose. And it is, of course, on the Republican ticket that Abraham Lincoln gets elected in 1860 by winning a majority of votes in the free states, who outnumber the voters of the slave states.
Bruce, as Lincoln proceeded softly on slavery and the Confederacy, Stevens was further ahead. How did their opinions differ?
Well, Lincoln saw the Union cause in the Civil War, initially at least, as suppressing secession as quickly and as expeditiously as possible. And like many others in his party, he believed that that could best be done by interfering with slavery during that war as little as possible. And that was because they falsely believed that the great majority of white people in the South were basically loyal to the Union, had simply been outmaneuvered, had been tricked into leaving the Union by a cabal of extremists, and that if the North could wage war against secession without politically ruffling the feathers of that presumably loyal majority, ruffling them any more than necessary, that majority would reassert control over the southern states and voluntarily bring those states back into the Union. Thaddeus Stevens could not have disagreed with that approach more. Thaddeus Stevens had always looked forward, as he said, to the day when loyalty to the Confederates, or better to say, loyalty to the slave owners, would cease. The slave owners themselves would lose their political standing in the Union, and the Union would finally be able to bring life in the United States into accord with the Declaration of Independence announcement of genuine human equality. That the war, in other words, would become an instrument for the immediate destruction of slavery. And so from the very beginning, Stevens and a handful of other radicals, and of course abolitionists, notably Frederick Douglass, the former slave, began pressing the Republican Party, and Lincoln in particular, to combine with the military struggle against Confederate forces a political and social struggle to undermine the Confederacy by doing away with slavery. So they're arguing not only that this is the right thing to do morally, but that it is the necessary thing to do in order to win the war, arguing that since slavery is the foundation of Southern society, of Southern economy, and a crucial source of support for the Confederate war effort, because who's feeding the soldiers? Who's driving their wagons? Who's doing all sorts of labor tasks? Because their owners are compelling them to do so in support of the Confederate armies. It's the slaves. Free those slaves, says Stevens, and indeed bring those liberated slaves into our armies as equal soldiers, and we will smash the Confederacy quickly, certainly more quickly than we will be able to do so otherwise.
All right, let's take a call. We've got Fred joining us from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, it's very interesting
let's see here. The clouds of Civil War were gathering over Kansas in 1852. My question is, why wasn't President Pierce, he didn't have a strong enough army. That's what my guess is, to put an end to that guerrilla action that was occurring in Kansas, Missouri.
All right. Bruce, is that something you can address?
Well, I'm not sure I understand Fred's question. Franklin Pierce...
I'll do it again.
Franklin Pierce wasn't president in 62, so are you asking about 52, Fred?
52, yeah, is what
That's
he
right.
said.
That's right. That was the gathering clouds of Civil War were occurring in Kansas in 52.
In 52.
Before the war, if the president was strong enough, he could have ended it, but he couldn't. He didn't go out there and do anything.
All right, Fred, let Professor Levine go right ahead.
Okay, well, Franklin Pierce, like Buchanan, who follows him, these are both Democrats. And the Democratic Party of the North is really enthralled to this Democratic Party of the South. Franklin Pierce, after all, vigorously supports the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which is precisely the act that opens the door to slavery in Kansas and Nebraska. So Pierce was not about to use the United States Army to put down the pro-slavery forces. And the guerrilla war that really breaks out after 1854, and which John Brown first makes his name, mm-hmm. Is one that apparently cannot easily be suppressed. The guerrilla war, as we all know, is something very difficult to put down.
We can go through a lot of what happened in the Civil War, but we only have a few more minutes left. So, Bruce, I want to also talk about Stevens's stance. He had strong opinions, in addition to being anti-slavery, very strong opinions on women's voting rights, Native Americans, Chinese immigrants. Tell us about what he thought about these things.
Well, as Stevens' life rolls on, his commitment to democratic principles seems to grow stronger and stronger and stronger, and to extend into areas that he had not made a mark on previously. So, for example, we were discussing his nativism mm-hmm. earlier. In 1860, the Republican Party finally puts into its platform an anti-nativist plank, a plank in defense of the rights of foreign-born citizens. Apparently, Thaddeus Stevens makes no objection, and that's new for Thaddeus Stevens mm-hmm. because previously he'd considered it politically advantageous to woo the nativist vote. And it seems that he has, at this point, among other things, come to recognize that a substantial portion of immigrants are opposed to slavery and that winning them to the Republican Party is more important than winning the nativists to the Republican Party. More dramatically, this individual had previously flirted to, I would say, his disgrace with nativism, now champions the rights of Chinese immigrants in California. A fellow member of the Republican Party brings a bill into the House of Representatives seeking to put a heavy tariff on a staple of the Chinese-American diet in California, something called clean rice. And in a speech in support of that proposal, this Republican denounces the Chinese in racist terms. And Stevens then pipes up on the floor of the House and says that California's treatment of its Chinese residents is disgraceful, that the Chinese have every right in the world to come to this country and participate in its benefits. And to do otherwise is a violation of the Declaration of Independence and a denial of the position of the United States as a safe haven for all the refugees of the world. Meantime, Stevens had come out in favor of women's right to vote, which is also a very small minority position in the country and in a public debate in Lancaster, Stevens is one of those arguing in favor of that right. So while, as one of Stevens' colleagues in the House says after Stevens' death, in late life, so many people become more and more conservative, the opposite seems to be going on with Stevens. He becomes more and more radical the older he gets, more and more committed to an expansive democratic set of values.
Such an interesting individual, a great book written by Bruce Levine. Bruce is a history professor for the University of Illinois, and his new book is Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Professor Levine, this discussion could go on for several hours, but I'm so glad that you were able to spend an hour with us talking about Thaddeus Stevens and his life. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you so much for having me on this wonderful show.
Great. You take care now. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro. It's directed by Danny McGivergan. And our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes or today's, if you missed some of it, on Vermont Viewpoint, about Vermont Viewpoint, by downloading our podcast. It's at wdevradio.com. We've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference coming up this morning at, 11:05, so right after CBS News. I'm Rick Singeri, and I will meet you back here tomorrow.